And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you on this Tuesday afternoon. And I'm joined by my colleague, Bonnie Berman, for today's program as well. Good afternoon, Bonnie.
Good afternoon.
Glad to have you aboard with me.
And glad to be with you.
Well, our guest is New York-based writer Elizabeth Klein. She's written Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. How has the saturation of discount stores changed the way Americans dress? And Elizabeth Klein joins us from Manhattan. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
So tell us how these relatively cheap clothes and shoes turned you into a fast fashion junkie, if that's the term.
I think that's a pretty accurate description. Yeah, I mean, I was essentially the typical American consumer. We're buying about 68 garments or and 7 pairs of shoes a year on average. And, you know, I got to a point where my closet was just overflowing with cheap clothes. I couldn't really resist a bargain. So I just, I got to the point where I owned almost 400 items of clothing, and it was, you know, I had it stored under my bed. It was in the basement. It was just everywhere. It was just like a clothing explosion, I guess.
I was surprised to learn there's a Kmart in Manhattan.
Yeah, I think it is one of the few remaining locations in the city. That store's been kind of squeezed by its competitors, like Target and especially Target. But there is one in Astor Place, and that's where there's the story that I tell in the very beginning of the book, where I go into Kmart and I see this pair of shoes. They're just like canvas slip-ons, very basic shoe, but they were marked down to $7 a pair. And I'd actually already bought a pair earlier in the season. I really liked them, but they were so cheap that they, of course, fell apart. So when I saw that they were marked down to $7, I actually cleared the store out of my size. So I bought 7 pairs of shoes. So I bought the my annual yearly quota of shoes in one shot there. And that was really the moment for me where I was like, I really wanted to look at how the declining price of clothing has made, you know, it's not just me, it's made most Americans see clothing as a disposable good. So it's something that we buy without really thinking much about it, and then, you know, just wear a couple times maybe for a season, and then it either sits in the back of our closet or we toss it out.
Now, you mentioned Target. That's sort of a cut above, say, a Walmart or a Kmart. My sister calls it Target.
Right. Target's been very good about, I guess adding value in terms of having better designed cheap goods. But they operate the same way that really a lot of the mass market clothing industry operates today, which is essentially they produce extraordinarily high volumes of clothing and all types of goods, and that's how they keep their prices low. And then, of course, they use low-wage foreign factories, which is what a lot of the mass-market fashion industry does today.
Elizabeth, how did Target get some of these high-end designers to design for them, like Isaac Mizrahi? And there are a few more that I noticed were now designing for Target.
Yeah, I think that I write in the book about that at some length, and I think what's interesting about that phenomenon is that designer goods they've increased their prices at the same time as the rest of the clothing industry has dropped their prices. So what you've got now in terms of options, if you're going out to buy clothes today, is you've got really cheap disposable stuff on one end, and then you've got this overpriced designer clothing on the other end. So, you know, I think that these designers, they know that most people can't afford their goods. So it's really not their main consumer are wealthy people. So it's not really a threat to them to produce at the low end. They're just reaching out to a new segment of the population, to the average consumer that can't afford their marked up higher end goods.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm just wondering if their high-end products are produced in different countries than their low end?
I think that every designer is different. I know that a lot of times with these collaborations, it's actually the cheap fashion chain that they're collaborating with handles all the production. So it would be Target, for example, that's sourcing those lines.
I see.
I mean, I don't think it's any big surprise that I can walk into Bergdorf's or Neiman Marcus and look at the labels on high-end lines, and a lot of them are producing in China now. Sometimes there isn't a big, a huge difference in terms of like the way the high end and low end is produced, which is another reason why consumers have gotten so cheap. We look at what the high end is doing and we're saying, they're ripping us off. So therefore I feel justified in shopping at Target and Forever 21. So in that way, it's like both sides of the fashion industry, I think, are really kind of manipulating consumers.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Klein. Her book is Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Elizabeth, today's Miami Herald had an article about the Bal Harbour shops here in Miami-Dade County. This is a very high-end mall with the Saks and Neiman.
And Prada and Hermes.
And they're reporting that their profits have never been higher. Is this indicative of the disparity of income that we see now between high and low and the erosion of the middle class?
I think so. I think that was one of the most, I think, sort of powerful things that I discovered when I was writing Overdressed, was that the clothing industry is always, it's a very good economic barometer. It tells you, it kind of shows you what's going on with the American economy. So just as we have, a shrinking middle class, we also have seen the disappearance of the middle in the fashion industry. And the wealthy are the largest consumers of fashion in terms of, dollars spent on clothing. And they are the ones that are shopping at those high-end stores. And then the rest of us are kind of left. I think for me what's so frustrating is, you always hear that we're living in this democracy and this democratic time for fashion, but I don't think that, being able to buy a polyester rag that's going to fall apart in a couple of washes is really a choice, because you could walk into a store and for a reasonable amount of money buy a well-designed garment that was actually going to last you a number of years, and that space in the middle is what's really disappeared.
Again, also, why is high volume at low price more lucrative for the stores than high price and small volume?
Well, that's a good question. It's more so that, like, now that you've got this whole network of factories spread out all over the world, and they're just producing so much clothing that in a way, it's almost like the industry is having to respond to the fact that these factories are producing such volumes. They're capable of producing such high volumes. And the other thing is, like, stores have figured out, especially fast fashion stores like Forever 21 and Zara and H&M, that if they put something out on the floor every day or every week, that consumers will come in all the time and buy something new. But the key to making that work is selling the product at a low price, because what really kills the clothing industry is when you put something out and then you have to put it on sale. So it just sits there and then you have to put it on sale. That's what really erodes the margin. So I think these fast fashion stores have just figured out that the key is to make clothing really cheap, train consumers that it's disposable, and keep them shopping all the time.
Elizabeth, why don't you give us a little history of American clothing and what's happened to the garment industry in America now?
Sure. So I wrote about, in the book I write, first of all, about the history of the department store, which is this American institution that has sort of disappeared in the last few decades. We still have department stores, but they're huge chains. All the independent department stores have sort of disappeared. And what's interesting about that is the factories that used to supply these department stores were all these like little independent mom and pop manufacturers, and the brands and designers that were supplying the department stores were also independent. So it was like you had this very vibrant, independent sort of retail scene and manufacturing scene. And now everything is just, you know, super consolidated. And all of these huge corporations, these cheap fashion corporations, I mean, it started with, you know, Gap back in the 90s, they rely almost exclusively on foreign, on low-wage factories in other countries. So what we've seen since 1990, we still made about half of our clothing here, which, you know, that's a pretty significant chunk, and now we make 2% of our clothing here. It's one of the most outsourced industries of anything that we buy. So, I mean, that's the trade-off is, okay, yes, we can buy a $10, you know, disposable dress, but we've also lost one of the most vibrant trades in this country. It was, you know, the garment and textile trades used to be a path to the middle class, and that's virtually gone now.
We're visiting with Elizabeth Klein. We're talking about overdressed, the shockingly high cost of cheap fashion. Elizabeth, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper here with Bonnie Berman. We're visiting with Elizabeth Klein. She's written the book Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. How have cheaper clothing outlets affected what you and your family wear? If you'd like to join in the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Or you can email at radio@WLRN.org. That's radio@WLRN.org.
Elizabeth, reading the book over the weekend, I was kind of struck by, you talk about cocktail party chit-chat between two women, and one compliments the other on her top, and she says, you know, $8 at Target.
Yeah. Yes,
quite a change in the chic world.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but yeah, it's certainly, I mean, we have bragging rights now when we score a cheap fashion find, and it's something that we all do. And I think that maybe it started with Old Navy. I remember in the you know, early to mid 90s, they really put a lot of money into marketing, changing the public perception of cheap, so that, you know, it used to be, you wanted to aspire to own the best things that money could buy, and through marketing by these companies like Old Navy and Target, we became convinced that you know, buying cheap things was a badge of honor. It made you savvy. It made you a sharp, smart consumer. You know.
Can we talk about how the whole process of producing cheap clothing, how it's a little bit like producing fast food, and what the process is and how it's hurting our society, the environment, and the workers who are making it?
Absolutely. I think that maybe one of the best parallels between fast food and cheap clothing is just this sort of it's like this feeling that you're eating but you never get full. That's how I remember my relationship with cheap clothing. I remember I was always buying new things, and I always had something new in my closet, but yet I always felt like I never had anything to wear. And I think that's partly because we are shopping on impulse. We're not really stopping and thinking, do I need this? Do I really like it? Does this fit me properly? Does it flatter me? But then there are so many other parallels. You know, I went to China undercover as a garment buyer, and these factories are just so savvy at producing the latest trends. You know, they can copy something so quickly. So that's the other thing is you know, we're all sort of wearing the same trends, and then we switch to a new trend after a couple months, especially in Brooklyn. I watched the trends change so quickly, and in that way, it is this very slick, industrialized system, you know, where we're constantly being marketed a new thing to wear. And then we just get, you know, after a couple weeks or a couple months, we're told, okay, that's not cool or that's not appropriate to wear anymore, and then we're supposed to switch over to the next thing. So it's just this, you know, this sort of never-ending cycle.
Again, we have lines open, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And also a little quicker, that's email at radio@WLRN.org. Tell me, Elizabeth Klein, how you went about to end your buy and toss cycle and what we can do as well.
Well, I think for me, I didn't really know anything about clothing. I write in the book that I owned more clothing than I did anything else and knew the least about it of anything that I buy. And I think that the key for me was really being able to understand clothes. So that means not just buying clothes because something's on trend, but really like trying to educate myself about fabric. So now when I buy clothes, I, you know, the first thing I do is look at the label and the fabrication label. And I'm like, you know, I'm not saying I never buy polyester, but I at least want to know what I'm buying. And the other thing is I buy a lot less clothing, and I really think about the whole life cycle of the garment, because clothing, you know, it takes resources. Human beings have to put it together. So, you know, part of being a responsible fashion consumer is thinking about, okay, once this is in my closet, how am I going to take care of it? How am I going to wash it? How am I going to make sure that it has the longest shelf life possible? And then how am I going to dispose of it responsibly? So it's really just about thinking about the whole picture of you know, where your clothing is going to end up and how it can really look its best and add to your life.
Elizabeth, I'm a boomer. I can remember on Saturday morning with my mother going downtown on the bus, and there'd be three big department stores that you could choose from, and having lunch at the department store counter. What a difference than going to TJ Maxx in the suburbs.
I know, absolutely, and I write about that.
And the windows.
Mm-hmm. I write about that in the book as well. And I think that that's another thing that I wanted to try and reconnect with in the book. And I do write about how independent retailers are starting to make a comeback. And I think part of why is because people are just getting sick of buying their clothes from these huge chain stores. And, you know, you end up owning the same thing as everyone else. And there's just something really satisfying, fulfilling about supporting a local business. You know, your money is going into the community, and yeah, it's just nice to know that you own something that's a little bit more unique. And I think that is what those department stores from, you know, the post-war period offered, was more unique, better made products.
But how, in the current economy, with so many people struggling to make ends meet, do we convince people that spending more in the short term will work out better in the long term, when people are living month to month now and it's hard to find the money, you know, to buy clothing when you're supporting a family and putting food on the table?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think that it is about... it is about shifting your spending. You know, as I said in the beginning of the call, that we are buying 68 pieces of clothing and 7 pairs of shoes per year. And a lot of that is essentially, I mean, it's garbage. A lot of it falls apart very quickly. So if you're really serious about, you know, budgeting for clothing, what you should do is sit down at the beginning of the year, the quarter, and say, what do I need? What do I really want? And try and put just a little bit more money towards something that's going to last a little bit longer. And that way you're not just throwing your money away on something that's going to unravel when you put it in the washing machine.
So you think in the long term, you're actually, even in the short term, you're actually going to be saving more if you just think more about what you're buying and put more, just put more thought into the whole process.
Right. I mean, I think that the average spending on clothing per year is $1,100, you know, per capita. So I think that if, you know, if you look at your clothing as an investment and you're building a wardrobe over time, then that money and the way you spend it is going to look very differently than the way what we're doing right now, which is, oh, I have a date on Friday, I'm going to buy something and never wear it again. You know, that's money down the drain.
Let's take a call or two. Again, our number 1-800-743-9576. We've got Sarah in Miami. Hey, Sarah.
Hi. I just wanted to say that it's completely true that when you make a list of what you really want and say, I'm going to buy the good quality products of this item as opposed to getting it at, you know, Forever 21 or Target, I've found that by making that switch over to buying the good products, I've saved so much money in my budget that I usually allot for buying clothing. So I really do think it's a great way to look at, you know, keeping your budget smart and having a really nice wardrobe at the same time.
How did you change? How did you go? Excuse me. How did you end your impulse buying? I mean, what made you stop that?
Well, I was finding myself, like, especially with like shoes, I would buy a pair of flats, you know, for work or something, and I would have to throw them out a month into having them. Like, it was just getting to a point that was ridiculous, and my mom kind of sat me down, and she's always been big on, you know, those signature pieces in your wardrobe that are really worth investing in. And I finally sort of said, okay, I'm going to spend the money now, and it's going to last me, hopefully. And it really has. I haven't had to, you know, buy a new pair of shoes in 6 months, and it's been great.
Elizabeth?
I think that's fantastic. I mean, that really resonates with what with my experience. I mean, I do remember when I was writing the book, the first time I went and spent a couple hundred dollars on a silk dress. It was, I was not used to that experience, and I had no, you know, I didn't really trust that this was a better way of shopping, and I'm not saying everyone has to spend $200 on a dress. I'm talking about my own personal experience, but what I found was, first of all, I took better care of the dress because I had actually put good money into it. And it's something that I took out and wore a lot more often. And it was something that I just felt better about wearing. And it is something that's still in my closet, you know, 2 years later that I still wear. And I love it. You know, it's just I have a better, a more, I guess, satisfying relationship with the things in my closet because of that shift. So I absolutely relate to what she's saying.
Okay, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll take another call before we take our break. This is Jenny in Key West. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm enjoying this. I retired a year ago, and I realized that so much of what I bought in clothes was for work. And also, as I got older, I'm in my 60s, gaining weight. And I remember, too, I enjoyed your comment about your mother going downtown and shopping and having lunch. Growing up in Chicago, I loved Marshall Fields, and you'd have lunch. And I remember the old grand dames on the second floor who in the waiting room, and I learned through talking to people that they would rework their clothes. Mm-hmm. And it is sad that that era is gone of, I mean, these are wealthy women, but they would have their tailor rework their clothes. And I think I agree with the author that there's this, I think she was suggesting that there's this big gap, not suggesting, she stated, between really low quality to high quality. And frankly, I'm disappointed with the high quality. I was listening to a program about Banana Republic and how sweaters were pilling after a week of purchase, and those were selling for $70 to $150. And supposedly they've taken care of the problem. I'm sure they're not appreciating my calling about this, but I remember going downtown in Chicago and spending more than I could probably afford, but I knew clothes would last longer. I remember items of clothes that were hand-me-downs from the 30s and 40s and 50s that were, you know, jackets, things that people might have saved.
I guess the era of hand-me-downs is long past.
But I remember the construction of those jackets from my mom's kid sister and other family members and friends that were just so beautifully constructed, and they would last forever if you took care of them. And I'm not quick to buy a $200 silk dress because, first of all, there's the cleaning. If you wash it, unless it's washable silk, it's going to disintegrate and not look very good. And I can't afford the care costs. And that middle market is gone. But I am glad to say that not working right now, I'm not fueled. My buying habits aren't fueled by that need to have something new to wear to work. And I've tried and not always succeeded, but I keep working at it, of having sort of a uniform without looking like a 70s nun in a black skirt and white blouse. And my question, though, is I'll stop reminiscing and ask, how can this all change? How can you educate the public? I think a lot of women spend too much money on clothes, and men are doing the same. And I can't remember her name, but there was a black author. I identify her as such because she had a grandmother who raised her and taught her the value of a dollar, and she's now the woman is a very successful in the business world, the business
Jenny,
woman.
We have a lot of other callers to get
yeah,
to, but
so
we really enjoyed...
Okay, and I just, she said, you know, if it's on your back, it's not an asset, and too many women are putting too much money into clothes, and I'd like the author to comment on that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I would just say that I think that the average American consumer we're spending the least amount in terms of percentage of our income on clothing than ever in history. So I think in terms of how the way we value clothing in terms of as it's represented in terms of how much money we spend on it, we spend very, very little on clothing today. So that's how I would respond to that.
The idea of buying cheap shoes doesn't sit quite right with me. Even when I couldn't afford them, I always wanted to buy decent shoes, you know, just so you're not getting blisters on your feet. And
yeah, the first caller, Sarah, I think was her name. She made that was a really great point. I think that disposable shoes, and that is how I start out the book, is by buying those seven pairs of shoes. That's one thing that you know, if it starts to fall apart with shoes, there's nothing you can really do about it unless they're made well enough to resole them. And that is something that I agreed with that caller on, is that's a huge thing that I've shifted in my own life, is I try and look for quality. I look at the sole, make sure that it's not just thinly glued on to the shoe. And that it's, and if I'm buying like leather boots, for example, I try and make sure they're sturdy enough to where I can go and get them resold, so they'll last a couple of years.
Let's take another caller on our program. We're speaking with Elizabeth Klein. This is Ruben in South Miami. Thanks for your patience, Ruben. Hi.
Hi. I guess I'm still on the subject of shoes. And what I've discovered over the years, I spent most of my working life in the car dealerships as a service consultant. So I was on my feet all day on concrete floors. And I found that if I bought cheap shoes, number one, my back hurt, my feet hurt. Number two, they wore out. So I started buying my shoes from Allen Edmonds. And they're, you know, $200, $250 a pair, but they outlast many of the others. So consequently, I ended up spending less on shoes. Since mostly retired, some of these shoes are still in my closet 6, 7, 8 years later. So... And the second point, I think one of your callers asked how we could educate the public, and I'm not sure I could educate, but what I can do is vote with my dollars. I buy the shoes that are made in Wisconsin instead of China. So anyway, that's just the point I wanted to make.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ruben. I just wanted to make one point that it is really difficult, like buying good shoes. We have an emailer here. Peter says, today I'm wearing Cole Haan shoes and belts, Levi's Target jeans, Gap dress shirt, and five-year-old Ray-Ban sunglasses. He says, a mix of high and low. Mm-hmm. So I think about the shoes, that's a really good point about using good shoes, but it is very hard to find shoe repairs now. I don't know about in New York, but it used to be that there was one like in every little area. Now it's very hard to find shoe repairs.
Right. And it is, I mean, that goes back to the point that the caller just made about voting with your dollars. If you've got that one shoe repairer in town, then, you know, if more people start, there has to be a demand is what I'm saying. If that's something that consumers want, then those businesses are going to open back up. So to an extent, it is about changing your habits and saying, you know what, I want to get my shoes repaired and supporting that one business that you do have in town. And I think that, you know, hopefully that we'll see it come back from there.
Again, our number, we have lines open, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN and email radio@WLRN.org. Elizabeth Klein, is this fast fashion trend in all developed countries?
Yes, and actually, one of the most shocking things that I found in writing Overdressed, and I write about this in the book, is that when I went to China and went to the factories there, I noticed that a lot of the girls behind the sewing machines were also wearing trendy clothes. They make very little money, but they're young girls. They spend their money on fashion, and I write in the book about, you know, imagining what's going to happen when as China emerges as a consumer country, they're starting to get the same fashion taste as the West. So that's another 1.3 billion people treating clothes as a disposable good. And so a lot of the environmental problems that we're already seeing in the fashion industry are just going to spread.
I had a question about the conditions in China.
Mm-hmm.
What were they like?
Well, you know,
in the clothing factories,
I think that I was shown probably factories that were definitely within. They were legally run and they were clean and all of that, because I was, you know, an American. I was presenting myself as an American garment buyer, so I wasn't going to see anything, sort of headline grabbing. But I think that, you know, the thing is that it's legal in China to pay poverty wages. Like, I didn't need to find a sweatshop to know that. And really, in all of the countries where we're making our clothes, Bangladesh, for example, perfectly legal to pay people $43 a month to make clothes. So I think for me, that's sort of the bigger point, is that, first of all, our factories in the States can't compete as long as these big fashion chains are paying such low wages, legally paying such low wages in other countries. But it's also, it traps these garment workers in other parts of the world in a life of poverty. They may not be working in a sweatshop, but they can't afford to go to school. They can't send their kids to school. In Bangladesh, most of the garment workers are living in slums. Like, that's not okay.
No.
Elizabeth, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book? And also, you have the Good Closet blog. Tell us about that.
Right. I keep a blog at thegoodcloset.tumblr.com, and there you can find a list of alternative brands and retailers. And another resource that I would direct people to is fashioningchange.com, and that is a website where you can sort of click off the brands and retailers where you currently shop. So let's say you're a fan of H&M or even like a higher-end line, like Marc Jacobs, it'll direct you to an ethical equivalent. So in terms of, if you're looking for easy ways to make a difference, that's a great resource. And then, you know, the main thing is I would also just tell people to really think about the whole life cycle of clothing. Don't treat it as if it's disposable. Even if you paid $10 for it, take care of it.
We have an emailer here, and I'm not familiar with this site, but maybe you are, Elizabeth. Would you address the popularity of such online stores as Etsy? Is that what that is?
Etsy, yeah.
Etsy, where buyers and sellers have a more personal and social connection than do shoppers in the chain stores. Do you see a long-term trend here?
I do.
That's from George.
I think that, you know, Etsy is it's a website of, you know, independent and handmade sort of artisanal products. And there's a lot of clothing on there. Some of it's vintage, and other sellers sell new handmade designs. And I think that, you know, Etsy it's a huge and growing web presence. And I think it's partly because people are, you know, this is people's livelihoods. Independent people that are producing products independently, they're doing it because that's their career. That's how they make money. And then people are supporting it because they want an alternative to corporate mass fashion. Again, they don't want to wear the same thing that everybody else has got. They want something that's a little bit, that's got more of a personal, more local story to it. It's just like how people have really gotten into the locavore, locally sourced food movement.
Right.
It's the same thing with clothes. People want, they want to know the people who are making their clothes, and they want a more unique, customized product.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Klein about her book, Overdressed. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman here, with speaking with Elizabeth Klein. She's written Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. And we're having a lot of audience participation, listener
Indeed.
Participation. We thank you for calling.
Elizabeth Klein, tell me how the fast fashion movement is hurting charities such as Salvation Army and Goodwill.
I wouldn't say that it's hurting them. What I found was that we're just donating such extraordinarily high volumes of clothing, and the quality of what we're donating has plummeted. Imagine that. So we're seeing the value of used clothing going down. And so what charities usually have to do, because we are donating way too much for them to actually resell it through the stores, is they sell it to textile recyclers, who then either sell it overseas, mostly in Africa, to secondhand vendors, or it's turned into fiber and wiping rags. But, you know, we're donating Target and Old Navy. It's, you know, if you go into a Salvation Army now, it's getting harder and harder to find those good sort of vintage finds, because the quality of what we're donating is going down. So that's just another example of how cheap sort of like trickles down and puts a lot of negative pressure on, you know, sort of like all parts of the clothing industry, even in its, you know, afterlife as secondhand clothing.
Let's go back to our callers. We've got Chris in South Beach. Hey there.
Hi, how are you? The point you just made really rings true to me, because I've been buying all my clothes almost exclusively at thrift stores for years, and I've always had a rule not to even consider anything by Old Navy or Banana Republic or Gap, and lately it's the whole rack, so it's not even worth going. But I've been going to websites more and more, like Gilt and those kind of designer discount sites, but it's hard to know if what you're getting there is really quality, because you're not actually touching it and looking at it until it comes in the mail. So I wonder
right.
what you think about that option.
Yeah, I've had the same experience. You know, he's talking about flash sale sites that sell higher end goods, and you're supposed to sort of buy them very quickly. And you're right, you don't get to see them. I mean, that is obviously just the drawback of shopping online. And I think the main thing with flash sale sites is just make sure that there's a return policy, because it is a good way to get a good deal on a better made product, but you don't really know until you get it in the mail if it's worth your money. So just make sure that you're checking that it's something that you can actually send back if it doesn't work for you, or if it's actually not put together that well.
And there's also this trend of designers being bought up by larger corporations and becoming part of the whole machine, it's hard to even keep track of who's part of what anymore. And so thinking you're buying an independent, you know, sort of limited production garment, it ends up being some kind of mass-produced thing anyway.
Well, I mean, I think in, you know, you have to do your homework to a certain extent. I mean, I do know what you're talking about. I don't know if, I wouldn't say it's, the problem is that it's mass produced. Like higher end stuff, a lot of the reasons why it's so expensive is because there's maybe, you know, in a single store, there would be one garment in each size. So the order sizes are a lot smaller. That's part of, I guess, being a responsible fashion consumer is doing your research on these companies and seeing how they run. And, you know, I went to buy a pair of Keds recently, and I was looking on their website, and I couldn't find out any information about where they make their shoes. So I emailed them and asked them. You know, to some degree, you have to be proactive and hold companies accountable to, you know, to how they produce their products.
Elizabeth, an emailer, Peter, writes that Brooks Brothers shirts cost $85 a piece. They last forever, but they still employ low-wage overseas workers.
Brooks Brothers is actually moving. They still produce some of their products in the U.S. I'm not sure about their shirts. And I know that they are actually in the process of moving more of their production back to the States. And that is an example of, you know, if consumers demand it, then these companies are going to respond. Because they reached out to me right after I put the book out, and they were really interested in what I was saying. And, you know, I think when they realized that there were consumers out there who wanted an American-made product, you know, that hasn't really been in vogue in decades. So now that people are saying, hey, wait a minute, we lost a lot of jobs, we want them back, companies are absolutely paying attention to that.
Interesting.
And we return to our callers. We've got Homestead caller. This is Margie. Hey, Margie.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a quick comment about the garment industry in Manhattan. My father worked in the garment industry when I was a little girl. I had wonderful memories of going downtown, taking the subway, seeing the garment workers with racks and racks of clothing, that clickety-clack sound of clothing racks going from factory to factory. I still love walking upstairs to the pattern room where those big machines would cut stacks of fabric. Mm-hmm. And these people took such pride in their work, and I remember going into the department store for which my father's company made coats and seeing my father's label. I still have a couple of these car coats. I'm 55. Mm-hmm. They were well-made, and the inside was as well-made as the outside. And that taught me when I started making my own for that reason, because you couldn't buy clothing that well made. Now, I grew up in an era where Singer sewing machine was in everybody's living room, but that has fallen to the wayside. Nobody has time to sew their own clothing anymore, and I've recently went back to it because the garments that you see in the stores are horrible, and I make so that they do last. The inside looks as good as the outside, and I wear them, and they're handy dandyable. I just wish we had that same pride back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the story of the uniforms, the Olympic uniforms being made in China. I mean, I remember my whole family just like, oh! If, like you said before, if the public demands it, it will happen again. But that's the first step. To keep the jobs here is a matter of pride. Are we proud of what we produce? Are we happy to put our signature on this? Yeah.
Okay,
I wear my own label. I don't want to wear somebody else's label.
Okay, Marcy, thanks for your thoughts.
I think that's... Can I just respond to that?
Certainly.
I think that that's a really great point, is that in a lot of what... A lot of the factories that are still in New York, their niche is producing... They still produce high-quality stuff. That's sort of our edge, but consumers have to... You know, I think Nanette Lepore is a designer who produces 80% of her clothing in New York, and that's a big part of her branding. And it's just really amazing. The garment trade, the industry there that's still in Manhattan, that's still in the Garment Center, is wonderful, and it is a very highly skilled little hub there. And I think that that that's really going to be the niche in the U.S.
What would be average wages in today's New York garment district?
Well, I think that the average garment workers make on average in the States around, I think it's like between $9 and $11 an hour. But if you have a higher skill and you've been in the industry forever, I had one person in the industry tell me that wages go up to $17 an hour. It depends on your position. And certainly as jobs have been outsourced, it's been harder to keep those jobs. Aren't as good as they used to be, I guess is what I would say. But that all goes back to, you know, like supporting the industry and keeping it here and keeping it competitive so that wages aren't suppressed.
Quick question, Elizabeth. I'm talking about the psychological component just really quickly. Mm-hmm. How do we get, you know, a lot of people just to feel good will go and buy something. So how can you just address that?
In 10 seconds.
I think that people are frustrated with their closets. So I think that, you know, that the first step is just really reconnecting with what you wear, demand quality, demand domestically made, ethically produced clothes, and take care of what you own, not just out of principle, but because it actually makes you happier with your clothing.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. It's been a very interesting hour. Elizabeth Klein, she's the author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. And thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our program. My apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by Paul Leary. Remember, there are book and author links at the Topical Currents Facebook page, including today's. Also find free audio archives and MP3 downloads on our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Thursday, we visit with an expert on home safety. It's no joke. These accidents are the fifth leading cause of death of Americans and injure some 12 million yearly. And to the calendar. On this day in 1777, 235 years ago, French nobleman the Marquis de Lafayette is named a major general in the Continental Army. He was but 19 and was wounded in the Battle of Brandywine. And on this day in 1919, 93 years ago, the birth of broadcast legend Kurt Gowdy in one of my favorite towns, Green River, Wyoming. He was the longtime voice of the Boston Red Sox, worked for ABC and NBC, and called the first Super Bowl. He died in 2006 in Palm Beach, Florida. One more. On this day in 1972, 40 years ago, Missouri Senator Thomas Eagleton, vice presidential nominee, withdraws from the Democratic presidential ticket of George McGovern 6 days after admitting he'd once been hospitalized for mental health problems. Our theme music created by Michael Devine. We leave with a thought from author John Updike describing Kurt Gowdy's homespun broadcast demeanor. Quote, he sounds like everyone's brother-in-law. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.